Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Riley, Judge Gaitis, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals, or should I say welcome to your homes or wherever you are today for our virtual oral calendar this morning. Our first matter on for argument this morning is Morey v. State of Minnesota. And counsel, just so that you are reminded, because we are having this oral argument electronically by Zoom, even though we can see each other and we can see each other's names, we're only making an audio recording of the proceeding. So please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument so we can attach you to your argument later on. Be mindful of the timing restrictions, which are indicated on the screen. And also, if there are any technological issues, which we have from time to time, we'll try to catch them and pause the proceeding. So don't worry about that. If we have a glitch or something, just let us know if you're having a hard time hearing or seeing anyone on the screen. Counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your argument, and respondent will have 15 minutes as well. 5 minutes additional to appellant for rebuttal if you choose to use that time. Counsel for the appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you have the floor. You are on mute.
My apologies. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Bo McGraw. I'm the attorney for Mr. Morey. We are before the court this morning as Mr. Morey has filed an appeal regarding a post-conviction relief petition that was denied by the district court. The real thrust of this appeal and the strength, I believe, of his argument to the district court relates to his issue of ineffective assistance of counsel, specifically his attorney's failure to investigate particular witness testimony that would have been made available. This is a case where my client
Whose testimony?
It's an individual known as Bobby Likens Jr.
Right. So if I understand the record correctly, and sorry for jumping in so quickly into your argument, but that was actually what I saw as the focal point as well, as you've pointed out. But as I understand the record correctly, no one gathered an affidavit from Mr. Likens or testimony from him. How do you propose that we overcome the prejudice prong of the Strickland analysis without knowing what he might testify to? All we have is hearsay. We have someone said that he said that he heard from someone else, such and such. So that itself is not evidence. So how do we get around the prejudice issue? So,
thank you, Your Honor. And please don't apologize for interrupting. The purpose of this argument is to help Your Honors to determine what you need by way of information. So I didn't represent my client on that post-conviction relief petition. He represented himself pro se. So I know that he did the best job that he could to try to put the proper evidence before the district court. I believe that an affidavit from Mr. Likens would have been of assistance. I believe potential testimony from Mr. Likens would have been of assistance. But what this court has before it is sufficient evidence to allow this ineffective assistance of counsel matter to be granted. So here's what we know. We know that my client testified, Mr. Morey testified, that he brought this information to the attention of Mr. Lunick, his trial attorney.
I just want to make sure that I also understand the record. It's my understanding that your client's wife is the person who said she had heard something, and it was the wife who told your client about what Mr. Likens might have said. Is that right?
It is. So here's the exact chronology, the best I can understand it. Again, I didn't represent him at the hearing. I understand that my client was in custody during the pendency of the proceedings. Ms. Morey received a message on Facebook Messenger that said, I have this information and you should get it to your husband and your husband should get it to his attorney. And then I understand that based upon that, Ms. Morey met with Mr. Lunick. She says 3 or 4 times where she believes she conveyed this information. And then Mr. Morey says that he conveyed the information to Mr. Lunick. So I think that's the chronology. And based upon their testimony, they said that Mr. Lunick said, I will go ahead and send my investigator out to contact Mr. Likens. We will conduct an interview, and it will be our intention to have Mr. Likens testify at trial. Underlying this entire case, these very serious allegations of sexual misconduct, the most serious nature that we see.
Let's assume that's all correct.
Yeah.
We still don't know. I mean, I still don't see how you get around the prejudice problem, because you've got Ms. Morey saying that she got some Facebook posts, but we don't have an evidence what those were. And you're saying that it would, all of this, I gather, should lead to some investigation of this guy Likens, so that the attorney could have determined whether Mr. Likens should testify about what one of the victims said to Mr. Likens. But without Mr. Likens saying what exactly he heard from the victim, how would we say that there is any, how would the district court in post-conviction ever say, well, you've overcome the prejudice hurdle. You've shown that if only you would have had Mr. Likens testify, the outcome would have been different. How do you get over that hurdle without something from Mr. Likens?
Well, I think, you know, I suppose what this court could do is remand it to the district court for further proceedings and give Mr. Morey an opportunity to compel the testimony of Mr. Likens to come before the district court, so the district court can have a more fulsome record of that issue. And Mr. Morey, if he would have been represented at the time of that hearing, that is evidence that should have come forward. I acknowledge that. It's not before this court at this time. It's not in the record of the district court. But what we do have in the record of the district court is that this evidence was brought to the attorney's attention. We had lay people that weren't knowledgeable in this space, and they hired an attorney for that expertise. Let's talk about that prejudice, Your Honor. So
before we get to that, the district court made credibility findings with regard to the witnesses who did testify and found Mr. Lunick credible and your client and his wife not credible. And so we can't make those credibility determinations. We rely on the district courts, who are seeing witnesses live and in person, to do that, or at least via Zoom, presumably last summer. How do you get around those credibility determinations?
Well, I would ask you to refer to that record in a fulsome manner. You know, there is he makes a determination that Mr. Lunick is more credible on these issues, but I would take issue with that. Mr. Lunick didn't deny that this information wasn't brought to his attention. Mr. Lunick's testimony was specifically that he just didn't recall that information brought to his attention, versus the testimony by Ms. Morey and by Mr. Morey, who were unequivocal in that they testified that they brought this information not once, not twice, but 3 to 4 times with Mr. Lunick. And then Mr. Lunick made a promise to go out and investigate this, which never happened. If I could shift to the prejudice piece just for a moment, because
before you do, I have an even more fundamental question on this issue, and that is, how can this particular issue not be now flabbard, given that, you know, all of the events underlying the ineffective assistance of counsel claim transpired before Mr. Morey's direct appeal to this court?
So my understanding, and we addressed this in the brief, that matters that would require additional testimony, meaning it wasn't a part of the record at the district court proceeding, the underlying trial, those matters that require additional testimony are properly placed in a post-conviction relief petition. But
that should occur before the direct appeal or concurrently with the direct appeal, not, you know, years after the direct appeal, if the issue was known at the time of the direct appeal, right?
I don't think there's any law that requires that a defendant bring a post-conviction appeal petition prior to a direct appeal. In fact, my experience has always been that a situation such as Mr. Morey, what he'll do is he'll meet with a state public defender, and the state public defender will review the record that it was fully developed and base an appeal strategy on that record, and typically advise clients in those circumstances that if they have post-conviction relief issues, such as an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, that that is more properly brought in a post-conviction relief petition, and that most times postdates the direct appeal. That's been my experience. I'm not aware of any case law that requires him to bring that post-conviction relief prior to the direct appeal. In fact, I think the timing requirements of the direct appeal necessitates an appeal on that record that was developed at trial. So I think and there's no claim that he wasn't timely on this part of the claim that I'm aware of. I understand on the process.
Although in reading the direct appeal, your client did try to raise the ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
On a pro se supplemental, correct? Yeah. Yep. And I don't think there's anything before this court saying that this issue of ineffective assistance of counsel is not properly before this court or wasn't properly before the district court. I think the NAFLA challenges, to the extent they exist, relate to the prosecutor misconduct piece. So if I can just shift to prejudice, because I know that that's been a big part of this discussion this morning, and I see it as an important part. Prejudice is viewed from the point of prejudice to the defendant. Our system of justice protects the rights of the defendants in cases such as this. This was a case where my client relied upon the strategy of his attorney. His attorney said this: there's no physical evidence linking you to these crimes. It will all come down to the credibility of the witnesses. That was the trial strategy. Here's what you had was a classic statement against interest, which is supported by the rules of evidence. There's no better way to attack the credibility of a witness than evidence such as this. And the evidence you have before you is that this attorney didn't follow through on that information provided by the client on numerous occasions. And the evidence at the post-conviction relief hearing from Mr. Lunick was, I don't recall. The evidence from the other two witnesses were unequivocally, I recall, this is how it happened. This is the frequency in which it happened. It's for those reasons that I'm asking that you grant the petition and remand this matter for trial. Thank you.
Not to beat the dead. And by the way, you don't have to reserve time. You'll have 5 minutes no matter what. I'm not sure if you were rushing to finish and save some time, but you have the 4 minutes left plus an additional 5 minutes.
I'm just trying to stick to this issue that I think is really principal to the court and not get caught up on the other parts of the petition.
Understood. So I'm still missing in your discussion, and I appreciate your acknowledgement that it would have been better to have Mr. Likens testify, but I'm still lost as to how the district court could have determined that the outcome of the trial would have been different, that there would have been some benefit. Let's assume there was an investigation. We don't know whether after an investigation, a reasonable attorney would have said, yeah, this is even worth putting on the stand. But it seemed, and I understand your client was mostly unrepresented, but at this stage, at least there's usually something we can point to say, yeah, you know, if a jury considering this might have come to a different outcome, this might have had some impact on the proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
So if this testimony would have came in the best way it could have come in, you would have Mr. Likens providing testimony that he overheard statements made by the complaining witnesses.
That's the problem I've got. We don't know what Mr. Likens would say. We don't know that he would say what you're suggesting, because all we've got is hearsay from Ms. Morey about what she says that she got on Facebook. We don't even have the Facebook messages or any conversation. So how would we even know? How would we even get to that point to analyze prejudice if we don't even know what he would say, whether he would corroborate your statements or not?
Admittedly, this post-conviction relief petition is made stronger with additional support relative to the testimony of Mr. One Bobby Likens Jr. No doubt about it. But we don't have that before you right now. So we can do one of two things. We can remand and give my client an opportunity, because he was in custody when he put this petition together. Now he has a lawyer. Give him 30 days to produce direct evidence to support his petition, which this court has the power to do. Or in the alternative, the court can look at the record that's before it. And the record that before it is, there's no evidence that was submitted by the prosecution that's saying the evidence wouldn't have came in that way. They don't have any, they don't provide any evidence that says Mr. Likens is a person that is not credible to provide this testimony. Yeah,
but the burden is on your client at this stage, not on the state.
It is. So what we have right now is we have a statement from my client supported by his wife who had the direct contact saying this is what his testimony would be. We have a trial strategy that was premised entirely upon discrediting the complaining witnesses. I can't think of any better evidence. Now, assuming it came in like this, Your Honor, any better evidence to attack the credibility of those witnesses than statements made by the complaining witnesses that we made it up. That's the testimony, that we made it up. And then it wasn't just we made it up because we want to make things up. It's we made it up because this living environment was too strict. We didn't want to live in it anymore. And this was our way to get out of it. And that was the trial strategy of Mr. Lunick. This testimony, if it was properly investigated, would have supported that trial strategy. So it wasn't.
Mr. McGraw, were you able to find in your research, I didn't see in your brief, but perhaps after you briefed the case, you were able to find some case law that would support this approach that you've suggested to the prejudice prong? The idea that, well, the evidence wasn't presented in the district court, let's send it back to the district court for the defendant to go and find the evidence to see whether or not it would overcome the prejudice prong.
I don't have any direct case law on that. If the court would like to keep the record open, I could research that issue. But I mean, this court has a long history of remanding cases back to the district court for further proceedings. That happens. It might happen in a quarter of the cases you see. I don't know the direct, you know, numbers on that. But it is a frequent occurrence that this court does that.
In this circumstance, I've never seen it. So I'm asking you whether you've come across a case where in this circumstance, where there's been no evidence presented as to what a witness would say, but that evidence is necessary to overcome the prejudice prong, where we say, well, you didn't do it in your first post-conviction hearing, let's send it back for a second post-conviction hearing.
I respectfully disagree with the court in one respect to your statement that there's been no evidence provided about what the testimony would be, because there was evidence provided. Fair enough. I acknowledge to the court there's other evidence that would have been more persuasive for the court and this court to review the record.
I guess what I meant was admissible evidence as to what he would say.
Correct.
Well, you will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you. Counsel.
Thank you. I'll hit mute.
Sure. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Catherine Lorsbach. I am the Clearwater County Attorney representing the state of Minnesota, the respondent in this action. The state of Minnesota requests that the court affirm the district court's denial of appellant's post-conviction relief petition on all grounds. Appellant has petitioned the court for relief for ineffective assistance of counsel, a claim that's bifurcated into two different theories and prosecutorial misconduct. I'll address each, but I'd like to work backwards and start with the prosecutorial misconduct. In his brief, Attorney McGraw opines that Attorney Mullen committed misconduct and that he did not produce exculpatory evidence that he or his agents knew or should have known of. The first allegation is that Attorney Mullen did not produce evidence regarding a child protection case. Appellant and his wife were both parties in that action and that preceded the trial. They had actual notice and participation in those child protection proceedings. There was no evidence unearthed at the evidentiary hearing held by the court to corroborate appellant's belief that evidence was withheld. The second allegation is that Attorney Mullen didn't disclose bad acts of one of the alleged victims whose case was later dismissed. In State v. NAFLA, the Minnesota Supreme Court held that once a defendant has had a direct appeal, he may not raise claims in a post-conviction petition that were raised or which could have been raised on the direct appeal. The Minnesota Supreme Court has recognized two exceptions: if a novel legal issue has been presented or if the interests of justice so require review. This issue is NAFLA barred, and prosecutorial misconduct is not a novel legal issue. It was available to appellant at the time of his initial appeal. Even if the court follows the theory laid out by Attorney McGraw in his brief, that this issue could not have been raised on appeal because additional fact finding was required, the court held an evidentiary hearing and discovered no additional exculpatory information that could have informed or swayed the jury. The interests of justice require no further review of this matter, The court found Attorney Mullen to be credible in his assertion that none of the information that appellate requested existed. The district court's denial of the prosecutorial misconduct claim should be affirmed. Additionally, we ask that you deny appellant's ineffective assistance of counsel claim. The claim has two different pieces, the belief that Attorney Luning was ineffective because he failed to present an expert, and his claim that Attorney Luning was ineffective because he failed to investigate and call Bobby Likens. Attorney Luning's representation of appellant was meticulously planned and executed, and his counsel and representation were effective as opined by the district court. The district court made findings that these claims were a matter of trial strategy and we're asking you to affirm that finding.
Well, I suppose whether to call a witness might be trial strategy, but how would failure to investigate be a matter of trial strategy?
With regard to not investigating Mr. Likens, the evidence that was presented at the evidentiary hearing is that the appellant and his wife, Ms. Morey, had asked that Attorney Luning investigate Bobby Likens, and that Bobby Likens had messaged Ms. Morey on Facebook stating that he had overheard the victims planning it all out and that he didn't believe them. So Attorney Luning's trial strategy, as he stated, was to keep the witness list tight and not to open up the defendant to any additional potential information that could have come out. In this case, the statement that Ms. Morey gave to the court during the evidentiary hearing is that Bobby Likens had contacted her on Facebook and that he had heard the boys planning it all out and didn't believe them. It's certainly reasonable to assume that Attorney Luning didn't want to investigate this claim and find out that Mr. Likens had heard the victims planning this out or had heard them making prior consistent statements, which could have resulted in prejudice to the defendant if the state had investigated that and found it to be accurate. And Mr. Likens' assertion that he didn't believe them is a statement of a lay witness, and is it best impeachment evidence?
I don't understand how it's a matter of strategy still not to investigate it to figure out whether or not Likens would be a credible witness. I mean, if assuming as true, as I believe we must, that the attorney heard from Ms. Morey that Mr. Likens had made this representation, why wouldn't it be compelling to go and why wasn't it enough to make it not only reasonable but compelling for a reasonable attorney to go and explore whether the victim has in fact fabricated the entire allegation, especially in a case of his word versus his word like this one, where you don't have physical evidence?
Your Honor, I don't have a good record as to why it didn't happen. It could have come down to credibility. It could have come down to
credibility.
Mr. Likens' credibility.
Right. And so if you don't investigate, if it would come down to credibility, if it's possible that Mr. Likens would be credible, and it's possible that what Ms. Morey told the attorney was accurate, as to what Mr. Likens believed he heard, explain the reasonableness of a strategy not to explore, not to investigate the possibility of those two things.
Your Honor, the trial strategy that Mr. Luning testified to during the evidentiary hearing was that he wanted to essentially keep the witness list tight. So by not calling additional witnesses, that is keeping the witness list tight. Certainly, it could have been looked into. It is something.
Let's say that's an overall good strategy to keep the witness list tight. But there's a possibility that one of the witnesses would say that the victims made up the entire he said versus he said allegation. If you're throwing witnesses out, trying to keep your witness list tight, presumably that would be the one and only witness you would call, right?
Your Honor, certainly, if the court views it in that light, then it should go to the Strickland test. And even if the court makes the determination that counsel's performance fell below the objective standard, which the respondent opines that it didn't, given that there is substantial and compelling evidence that was presented in this case. The appellant can't prove the reasonable probability exists that the outcome would have been different but for this error, in light of the significant additional evidence that was presented against appellant at his trial, which included statements of the victim, which the jury did find compelling, but that wasn't the only evidence that was presented.
Well, I guess I'm lost. Are you saying that we should accept the possibility at this stage that Mr. Likens would have testified credibly in the way that Ms. Morey says she heard from Mr. Likens about Ian?
I am not, Your Honor. Mr. Likens' testimony was not presented. His Facebook conversations with Morey were not presented. There is no evidence except for the statements made by the appellant and Ms. Morey, who the court found to be not credible, that support this assertion that Mr. Likens was not called. The appellant knew going into his trial that Mr. Likens was not going to be called. He knew that wasn't somebody that had been witnessed by Attorney Looning, and he still proceeded to trial with Attorney Looning. He didn't fire him. He didn't ask for additional time. He didn't ask for a different counsel. He knew that witness list, and he testified in his evidentiary hearing that he was pleased when they went to trial. So for somebody who is not deemed to be credible by the district court to state, well, this happened, it's hearsay. This is a statement.
Well, Ms. Lorsbach, do we even in this record have any evidence that Mr. Likens exists beyond the testimony of Mr. Morey and Mr. Morey's wife?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. He was not called as a witness at trial, which the appellant knew going into that trial and knew well before trial started.
So essentially, the entire argument being advanced here is based on speculation, essentially, and speculation that the post-conviction court found to be not credible.
That's correct. Additionally, there was significant evidence that was presented, so we don't believe that the prejudice prong has been met. Additionally, the court made credibility determinations when doing the findings of fact and conclusions of law, and those are adopted by this court. And so we would ask that the court not even when reviewing this, that the court affirm the findings of the district court that Mr. Looning was not ineffective for failing to investigate this purported witness, and that Mr. Looning did effectively represent him.
I believe you were also going to discuss the other basis for the alleged ineffective assistance of counsel.
I was, and that was the allegation that Mr. Looning did not call an expert on behalf of appellant. The court held the evidentiary hearing, and with regard to the expert, the decision whether or not to call the expert has been held to be trial strategy under State v. Francis. Mr. Looning laid out his trial strategy to keep it tight. He opined that calling the expert witnesses requested by appellant could have significantly undermined the strategy and opened the expert up to detrimental cross-examination by the state. He was concerned that an expert called to examine the victims for evidence of trauma could result in physical evidence that would be used by the state against appellant, and that the expert could have been rebutted by a state expert that the absence of trauma and sexual assault victims is not necessarily an indicator that no assault had occurred. So the decision not to call an expert in this case is a trial strategy. It should not be reviewed by this court. And the decision not to call an expert as to the duality of homosexuality was in line with Attorney Looning's trial strategy. It shouldn't be questioned. Again, we have a circumstance where Mr. Mori, the appellant, presented no experts testified. And when questioned by the court, appellant wasn't able to say who he would call. He just reasoned that if he had called an expert, they would have greatly increased his credibility. So we don't believe that appellant has met his burden in this. And we would ask that the court affirm the district court's order.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any rebuttal?
Yes, thank you, Your Honors. I'll be brief. You know, I'm well aware of the challenges of this record, but there's been no evidence before the court, and there's been no argument made by counsel representing the state that there is not a person by the name of Bobby Likens Jr. So that has not been proffered by anybody. But what we do know is that there's two witnesses that have come forward that have testified that they brought information to their attorney relative to Mr. Likens, and the attorney didn't.
Let's explore that. What does the record tell us about where Mr. Likens lives?
I don't know right now, Your Honor. I don't know.
Does it tell us how old? Do we know how old he is from the record?
We don't.
Do we know his criminal record?
We don't.
So, I mean, you're right. No one's made the argument that he doesn't exist, but the record doesn't tell us that he exists.
And we have to have a healthy understanding at the same time that my client tried to kick and scream and claw his way through a legal proceeding that had a lot of challenges to it. And that's a
Mr. McGraw, I'm looking at paragraph 13 of the conclusions of law, and the judge found that the testimony of Mr. Lunick shows that he knew of Mr. Mori's suggestion that Mr. Likens and third-party providers be interviewed as possible witnesses, and it was agreed between Mr. Lunick and Mr. Mori that they would not be called as part of their trial strategy. So how are we to view that conclusion and finding by the district court, who sat through a evidentiary hearing in which your client testified and was found not to be credible?
But that contradicts Mr. Lunick's own testimony, where Mr. Lunick testified that he didn't recall receiving information about Mr. Likens.
So you would argue, I don't want to put words in your mouth, that that's a clearly erroneous finding.
I would. And I think there's other parts, with all due respect to this district court judge, who I know everyone tries to do the best job they can, and there's no disrespect here, but he grouped everything in this bundle of a lawyer, as long as a lawyer's acting strategically, a lawyer can do what a lawyer needs to do strategically. We know that case law exists, but really I'd ask the court to find that the court was misplaced in packaging this case in the strategic case law argument. This is really about a failure to investigate. And the best instruction for the court to look at would be the Wiggins v. Smith decision. It says, in order for a counsel to be effective, if counsel has been appraised of a possible defense, here the evidence is he was, he or she has an obligation to follow through on the information received. The testimony is Mr. Lunick not only doesn't testify that he followed through on it so he could provide his attorney with good insight, his client with good insight about whether or not to include that person on the witness list. The testimony from Mr. Lunick is that he didn't recall receiving the information, despite two witnesses saying he did receive it. Wiggins further goes on to instruct, strategic decisions made after a less than complete investigation are reasonable only to the extent the limitations of the investigation were reasonable. I want to keep the witness list tight, but I believe my overall strategy is to attack the credibility of the witnesses. There's no physical evidence. I had to get the jury to not believe these people. But now I have a statement.
You're not arguing that Mr. Lunick didn't do a good and proper cross-examination of the victims in this case.
No. He just left one big tool out of the toolbox, which was a statement against interest, potentially, if this evidence exists and is to be believed. And I understand the challenges of this record, but I ask that you don't hold that against my client, that you allow him an opportunity to produce Mr. Likens under the power of subpoena, which I can execute on his behalf, get Mr. Likens in a courtroom, and we can figure out exactly what he told the Moris when he told them this information.
Now, sometimes on appeal, lawyers who see a gap in the record might go and do their own appellate work, investigation, get a hold of a witness and get an affidavit to try to supplement the record and show what would have been presented. I'm not faulting you for not doing that, but am I correct that even on appeal, we don't have any representation about this Mr. Likens and his what he would say?
We don't. And my understanding is that I appeal the record that was developed at the district court. I'm not aware of anything that allows me to supplement that record on appeal. If that opportunity does exist, and if there is that ability to do that, I would ask that you don't hold my deficiency against my client.
just to be clear, when in our practice of supplementing the record, it's generally the case of there was evidence that had already been created and somehow didn't make it into the record. So I'm not inviting you to go and run out and find Mr. Likens and get an affidavit. I don't want to be responsible for you having to go and do work that we don't consider. So don't feel like that was an invitation. I was just curious whether hypothetically there might be something out there. So your time has expired, and thank you both for your arguments, both on brief and today in our oral discussion. We appreciate it very much. It's very helpful to us. Well done. I would say both of you have represented your clients very well.